Before President Trump called on NFL owners to fire players who protested during the national anthem, one youth football team in Southern Illinois knelt to protest police brutality in St. Louis.
Whatever your feelings were about what the 8-year-olds had done was just driven to the extreme, either by what the president had said or by the demonstrations of the NFL.
We'll hear about that Illinois story from the Belleville News Democrat's Todd Eshman. We'll also talk about the role of politics in sports with WBEZ's Cheryl Ray Stout and sports sociologist Wib Leonard.
All social institutions are infused with politics. Religion is infused with politics. Law is infused with politics. And sports are no exception.
Plus, why many people across Illinois live in areas where there aren't enough grocery stores nearby. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned.
A note to listeners about today's program. We'll be talking about the controversy surrounding protests during the national anthem at sports events. The discussion includes reference to comments made by President Trump about those who protest. Some may find language in the program objectionable.
Welcome to the 21st. I'm Yvonne Greer in for Nyla Boodoo. Pro football tends to dominate our Sundays in the U.S. each fall as arguably one of the biggest events of the week. But this past weekend, the biggest story in the sports world was happening before the games even started. Last week, President Trump called on NFL teams to fire players who protested racism and police brutality during the national anthem by taking a knee. During the week's games, players from every team and even some coaches and owners responded by joining in protest during or before the national anthem. Some taking knees, other locking arms with each other. Some teams like the Pittsburgh Steelers didn't even come out of the locker room before the game began against the Chicago Bears. Here in Illinois, a youth football team of 8-year-olds in Cahokia, just 10 minutes east of St. Louis, took a knee during the national anthem in response to former St. Louis police officer Jason Stockley's acquittal in the fatal shooting of Anthony Lamar Smith. This all happened before the president's comments on kneeling during the national anthem over the weekend. It has sparked lots and lots of conversation across our state and across our nation as a whole. Joining us now on the line to talk about this is Todd Eshman. He's the sports editor at the Belleville News Democrat. He's been writing about this. Todd, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
So set the scene for us, if you will. What happened at that youth football game in Cahokia?
Well, this actually happened here in Belleville at a youth game. What we're told is, according to the coach, who's a fellow named Orlando Gooden, he's a former athlete at Cahokia, in the aftermath of a practice and in the aftermath of the verdict on the Lackley case, some of the students, according to Gooden, asked him what this all meant, what was going on, what were the images they were seeing on TV all about. According to him, the conversation was led by the youth players, and they decided collectively that they would like to demonstrate by taking a knee. And this was done apparently with the support of the parents as well. So they came for their Sunday game here in Belleville, and as the anthem played, it was reported originally to us that they had taken a knee and turned their backs on the flag. We don't see that they turned their backs on the flag. In fact, it kind of looks like nothing in particular had the collective attention of all the players, but they were on their knee with their coach during the playing of the anthem. This was captured on video by several of the parents that were in the stands that day and who contacted us about what was going on.
I think it is an important distinction, as you note, that the 8-year-olds were brought into the decision-making process. So this wasn't the coach telling them to take a knee. This was them asking questions and a sort of a group, collective team decision to do this, yes?
That's how it was presented to us by Coach Gooden, yes.
But how has the age of the team affected the response to this story in the community?
You know, you had mentioned that there was a lot of discussion up and down the state, and there certainly was on our social media platforms. And, it had a wide range. It sparked the whole debate about kneeling versus standing. But there was that third group who were divided. Even some of those who support the football players' demonstration of kneeling question whether or not you know, is this appropriate for an 8-year-old? Can they even understand cognitively mm-hmm. what this sort of protest means? So that was actually the topic of a follow-up story that published today.
Have you had opportunity to talk to the coach about this protest?
I did. And he was for the original articles that we did, he was very open about it. And I actually just spoke to him earlier. He said the response he's gotten was wide-ranging as well. He's received plenty of support. He also received plenty of what he called naughty emails. I like the word.
What does that mean?
There.
you just mean bad words in the emails. Got it.
That's how I take it. But he also said that he was welcome. He wanted to reiterate to those people who called that in his heart is the words he said, that there was no disrespect intended to the troops or to the police. But that he felt like he had an opportunity to explain a social issue to the 8-year-olds and that he should give them the freedom to then express their feelings about it. One thing that he was particularly thankful for was he said some of the people that were angry with him that may have sent those naughty emails, that he had some contact with some of them, and in many cases the conversation ended on sort of amicable terms where, you know, they agreed to disagree, but he was just thankful to have that opportunity to interface with the other side, so to speak, and explain what the intent was.
And I would imagine that the events of this past weekend with the NFL has just sort of escalated the conversation, especially on social media, and I would imagine around coffee shops in Belleville as well. How has the national story affected the way the local community is handling it? Has it sort of cast a different light on it? Are people more accepting of the 8-year-olds taking the knee, or that much more upset if you were on the other side?
I think that much. Well, I mean, it's a divisive issue anyway, and I think whatever your feelings were about what the 8-year-olds had done was just driven to the extreme, either by what the president had said or by the demonstrations of the NFL, one way or the other.
So really just a reinforcement of what people already believed?
Exactly. That's how I would interpret it, yes.
Got it. Todd Esham, sports editor with the Belleville News Democrat. Thank you so much for being with us on the 21st.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I also want to add to this conversation with Cheryl Ray Stout. She's a sports contributor for WBEZ. Cheryl, welcome back to the 21st.
Hello. How are you, Yvonne?
Great. Thank you. I know you had an opportunity to listen to Todd's portion of the conversation there. So help us put this into perspective from where you're sitting. What stands out to you most about that story?
The fact that the children had the wherewithal and the decision to do it together, it says volumes. It means, I think the kids understand these issues. They live it every day. And so for them to be able to express themselves, that's important because we have to create a dialogue, and this dialogue seems to be muted every direction.
So you've been following this issue of the football players kneeling during the national anthem, and now the president making himself a part of the debate has made this story a lot bigger. What did you see from the NFL over the weekend?
Well, it was interesting to watch because first you saw the rally with President Trump in Alabama, and when he brought up, you know, the players in the NFL and saying they should be fired if they kneeled and calling them sons of bitches, which really, that was a spark that really ignited the NFL. His tweets on Saturday, which continued with the NFL, also included the NBA when he disinvited the Golden State Warriors, specifically Stephen Curry. So that set into motion a lot of things that would happen on Sunday, because on Saturday, that's when the NFL teams are playing on Sunday. They have their meetings. They just have meetings. They don't do much more than meetings before their games on Sunday. And as for the Bears, that's the team I was covering, mm-hmm. they had a group meeting with the owner, and the owner talked to them about, you know, his feelings, and he said, whatever you do, you have to do it in unity. And after Sunday, when the Bears were locked arms, the Steelers were not on the field except for one player who was a former Army Ranger. The thing was with the Bears, when we talked to them in the locker room about it, there was a lot of emotion. there was a lot of players are saying, you know, this was really, you know, it was very hard for them to think about what the president had said about them. And the thought was, when I talked to Danny Trevathan, he was the one that came up with the ideas with the locked arms. He said, it's very hard for me to look at my daughter and not let her understand that we didn't do anything, so we had to do something. And not all the players agreed on, you know, because they had a choice of kneeling or not going out or locking arms, but they came to it together. And the one thing is, the word that they kept using was divisive. You know, what the president said was divisive.
Mm-hmm.
The only issue I take with this is that going forward is the message is being lost about social injustices, and that's got to be really at the forefront of this.
These protests, as you mentioned, are in response to police brutality cases across the country against Black Americans. Last month, Seattle Seahawks defensive lineman Michael Bennett was held down by police in Las Vegas after he tried to run from safety from a nearby shooting. They falsely believed he was a suspect in that shooting, but Bennett said afterwards, while he was lying on the ground, all he could think was, quote, "I'm going to die for no other reason than I am Black and my skin color is somehow a threat." In the NFL, you're looking at a predominantly Black league with mostly white owners and execs. Do you think the players are starting to change the owner's mind about this issue?
I doubt that, but we have to see what they do going forward. Remember, they didn't react to anything until the president said something. And the president said, you know, fire people. The president said, don't go to games. And so what, by attacking the NFL, he was attacking the owners where they make their money, and that is people buying their product, going to their games. So it was more about their branding, I think, than about the issue. However, I do believe that the discussions are there. I was at a Bears practice, the only practice they had this week, and they will be continuing the discussions, and players that they want to actually do more. So I think the seeds are there for the players, and it'll be interesting to see how the owners take it from here.
There's that dual issue also of Steph Curry being disinvited to the White House. Was there much fallout amongst the Bears about that?
Well, not about the Bears. I was at the Bulls, their opening of training camp on Monday, and the NBA, all the teams, I believe, are going to have meetings about this, talking about it, and how they're going to handle the national anthem, because they're just starting their training camps. They haven't played any games yet. But the NBA has always been much more vocal in the last few years than almost any league. The interesting side of this, some years ago, in 1995, 96, there was a player, Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, who was a Muslim who decided not to stand on the court for the national anthem, and he was suspended a game, and then the NBA and him had come to an agreement where he would stand with the team, but he would pray. He would be in a praying motion.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened after that was, that was resolved, but he never played much after that. He was only 29, and he was kind of, you know, pushed aside. So it's interesting when you scroll up from 95, 96 till now, to finally the NBA, their social conscience is aware, and they are expressing it. And you have to credit the fact that social media has allowed the information and allowed the reaction to happen as quickly and as widespread as it has.
For those of us who may not follow sports as closely as you do, for sure, is it that the NBA tends to be more politically outspoken than the NFL? Has that historically been the case?
Not until recently. I mean, I think in the last few years, players, and like I said, I think social media has helped them with their platforms, and they feel, you know, they feel safety. And also, here's the difference in the NBA and the NFL. In the NBA, they have secured contracts. So they feel they could do this, you know, and they have other reasons why. I'm just saying monetarily. In the NFL, players can get cut. Look at Colin Kaepernick. He is still not with a team. He hasn't had a trial for a backup or for a starting quarterback, and he's one of the better quarterbacks. He has a better quarterback rating than a lot of players that are playing right now. So it's an interesting, different. There's a huge chasm between the way they both have looked at it.
So do you see this as support for Kaepernick or just sort of retribution against the president's comments, with the NFL being involved in taking a knee collectively as a team? as teams?
I think initially it's been the president. But I think going forward, if there is more, if it takes a bigger platform for them, if they do more vocally, then we'll know more about them. I just think right now it was reaction to the president. There were several players that were already doing the kneeling, but now there's more. And so it's going to be interesting. And the one sport that still doesn't do it is baseball, except for one player. An Oakland A's player did it a couple of days ago. So it's interesting how the different interests and how they decide to go forward will be the telltale of how they took what happened last week into heart.
It is very interesting to watch. WBEZ sports contributor Cheryl Ray Stout, thank you very much for your input and your insights. Thanks also to Todd Eshmans, sports editor at the Belleville News Democrat. When we come back, we're going to hear from sports sociologists about how the athletes can affect social change. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting Propositions on Revolution, Slogans for a Future, part of the campus-wide commemoration of the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Yvonne Greer, in for Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking with WBEZ sports contributor Cheryl Ray Stout about football players protesting during the national anthem. Before that, we learned about a youth football team in Southern Illinois that also knelt to protest police brutality in St. Louis. We'd like to bring in now sports sociologist Wib Leonard. He's a professor at Illinois State University, and he spoke with us last week about the importance of speaking out about their battles with mental health. Wib, welcome back to The 21st.
Thank you.
So the last time you were on the show, you spoke about the importance of athletes speaking out about their own personal struggles with depression and other types of mental illness. Does this also apply to athletes speaking out about social issues too?
Yes. As a sports sociologist, I want to frame my answer with a couple of sociological observations that I think are very relevant. First of all, social life by its very nature is political. Power and influence are erstwhile social phenomenon. Secondly, ideology plays a very important role in terms of how we define, how we assess, how we interpret social events. All social institutions are infused with politics. Religion is infused with politics. Law is infused with politics. Medicine, education, and sports are no exception. Maybe in a utopian world, we could divest politics from the nature of the social institution, but that's an utopian world. Now, the question to me becomes, are the athletes out of line when they make such protest movements?
Mm-hmm.
My answer is an unequivocal no, they are not out of line.
And what makes you say that?
Oh, well, first of all, the Constitution, the First Amendment, guarantees us the right of self-expression. And certainly the athletes that we saw this past weekend were demonstrating that. However, what is striking to me, since I've done my share of research in this area, is the collective component of what took place this past weekend. Over 200 football players took the knee or sat on the bench or did not recognize the anthem or the flag. There have been historically a number of individuals that have protested social issues like oppression or social injustice, but I've never known such a large collective outpouring of support. However, if you look at, I'm thinking of the modern Olympics since 1896, mm-hmm. virtually every single Olympiad has had issues that have been what we would call political in nature. So when you say to me, well, why not? I think it is dictated by the First Amendment. The only thing, though, that I have, it's a conundrum to me, is that it took place, all the NFL teams, save the Green Bay Packers, and they're an outlier, are privately owned. And so my guess is that each team would have to or could make a policy on what they would like. And we do know that there were teams like, the Pittsburgh Steelers, the Seattle Seahawks, that for one reason or another did not come out in protest. But it has taken place on such a gigantic platform, a gigantic stage. Not only do you have thousands and thousands of people in the stands, but you have millions of people that are out there watching on television.
Mm-hmm.
So whether this becomes a social movement, and I think the person that went prior to me had indicated this, whether it becomes a longer-lasting matter is unknown at this point. I'll be very curious to see what transpires in the next few weeks.
It's interesting to me that we hear so much about, I mean, as you started the conversation with, politics is infused into every aspect of our society. Yet almost at every turn we hear, I just want to watch football. Politics has no place in football. And if we're watching the award shows, the Grammys or the Oscars, and an actor or an actress or a singer or performer says something political, then the audience at home says, I just wanted to watch the Grammys. Why did they have to go and make this political? How is it?
Well,
I mean, what is a good place, area, venue to talk about politics outside of us here in the media setting and in, you know, newsrooms, I guess?
Well, I believe that in any every social setting, here I am at a university, and I know that as a public employee, there have been a few years in which we faculty have protested. We wanted to unionize. So even in that setting, we made our feelings and our aspirations known. What I think is the case is that somehow, I used the word utopian earlier, maybe in some ideal world, we hear that, well, politics should not be part of the Olympics. Well, every darn Olympiad that I have researched has had these implications to it. So to answer your question, I think that it's kind of a pie-in-the-sky belief that politics should not infuse, whether it's the Grammys, whether it's professional sports, whether it's education, whether it's religion.
Could it be that these are our sources of entertainment? You know, I watch football to escape from the real world. I watch television to escape from the real world. Almost like somebody walking in when you're watching something, your favorite show on television, and interrupting you. I wonder if that's maybe what that feels like. Don't interrupt my entertainment with your politics.
One of the roles of entertainment, whether it's sports or something that we see on television, it is this escape phenomenon from, let's say, the issues that we have to deal with in everyday life. And I have seen some statistics that maybe 70% of those that were surveyed were opposed to these political protests on the part of the NFL athletes. So I do think that the spectator out there, there is something about, hey, just show me the game, show me the activity, and I don't want to have to deal with that other side.
It's Cheryl, Cheryl, I want to bring you back into the conversation. Earlier, Wibb talked about how he wasn't sure what kind of mass long-term impact this was going to have. And I wonder if it speaks to what people consider to be the motivation behind taking the knee or staying in the locker room or locking arms. Shannon Sharp, Chicago-born tight end who played for both Denver Broncos and Baltimore Ravens, took to the airwaves this week, and he said he believes that this is really this collective taking a knee and locking arms and staying off the field during the national anthem, that this is more about President Trump and the NFL owners not wanting to be told what to do by the president, and that there's not this big social issue going on. Do you see it that way?
It could turn out that way, but maybe the players will have their platform and express it even more contrary to what you're talking about. I want to bring this one fact up that people don't remember or don't understand. Do you know the NFL players didn't stand on the sidelines until 2009? They were in the locker rooms, and the only reason why they are on the field is because they're getting paid by the government. They get paid by the government for advertisement. So it's kind of interesting that this whole thing blew up about the national anthem when that wasn't even an issue or couldn't be an issue until 2009.
And how when people see it, they see it as an affront to our troops and our veterans.
Right. And, you know, and Colin Kaepernick, when he first did what he did, he sat on a bench. And he sought out people in the military to ask him how to handle it. And he was told the reverent way to do it was to do a knee. And so he sought out the way to do it that would not anger people, and yet it still has become people are questioning people's patriotism over this. So it's become this issue that if the players are going to have to do something, I don't think the NFL, I don't think the NFL and the owners are going to do as much. I think it's going to be the players, and they do have platforms. They can do something about it. They can be more vocal, and I think maybe after this weekend, they feel that they can do more.
Do we know if this is having an actual impact yet on viewership and attendance?
The ratings were up. The ratings were up this weekend. So, but you know, there's been a lot of other issues going on with the NFL as far as attendance. So that's an issue that several things. That's the concussion issue. That's you know, the fact that the monetary issue. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why there's a lot of bad football being played. So it's hard to tell if this has an impact on it. But I read the ratings the other day, and they were up.
So, Wibb, how does having an athlete speak out about political issues differ in the average person's ear than having a politician speak out about political issues?
Sports are such a mass phenomenon. The role model that they sometimes provide us means that they are sometimes considered to be larger than life. And politicians, I mean, we've seen ratings of the acceptance of politicians. It tends to be low. But athletes are typically put upon this pedestal. And so you combine the role model that they are, despite some wanting to say that they would prefer not to be that. You combine that with the numbers that are out there viewing makes them so much more significant, in my judgment.
Now, I'm no sociologist, but just from my perspective and my social media feeds, it almost seems like we don't really want to have a conversation, but rather people want to express their point of view and just have it be out there. How do we go about having these kinds of conversations with each other without having them blow up? I can't imagine how we're going to come to a meeting of the minds unless people actually start talking to each other instead of at each other, if you will.
I'm thinking of the compromise that Jerry Jones came up with. It was a joint venture. That is, he locked arms in a kneeling position, which I interpret as accepting the protests that were taking place. After that, the team went to the American flag, the national anthem was played, and they interlocked arms there. So when you have the cooperation of not only owners but coaches and certainly players in other sports supporting that, I think that is at least a start for some type of dialogue. And what I am not convinced of is, and we'll know more later, that I think the tweet or the statement that Trump made on Friday just created this firestorm. Was it created to divert attention from issues like North Korea, the health care program? I'm not so sure. But I think anyone in any line of work, if they were attacked like he attacked them in terms of fire the sons of bitches, that type of thing, would also respond in that fashion.
So going forward, Cheryl, what do you think we can expect to be the focus of these anthem protests?
We'll know more like on Thursday night when the Bears are playing Green Bay and see if they, because when I talked to them, they hadn't made a decision what they're going to do. Are they going to continue this? Are they going to, you know, will there be more done with the players and maybe the Players Association, which was very strong about it? That's what we have to see. We have to see if players are going to be, I was talking to one player, Prince Mukamura. He was saying that he wants to see more players being involved with talking and going to Congress and actually seeking out some resolutions on some of these problems. So I think we have the seeds in the players. That's where I really believe that's going to be. The ownership, I don't know if the players quite trust them, although, you know, they're locking arms. Yes, there's some of them, not all of them. So that's where you have to really look at the focus. What do the players do? And I think that's going to be developing in the days and the weeks to come.
And socially, what can we expect if those players do continue this movement? Wib.
I think, you know, they're going to get some backlash from people because people are not happy about play. People are always saying, well, you're making millions. You know, what do you have to complain about? Well, if you talk to a player of color, they've dealt with their color for their whole life. And it's not like it just changed because they made millions. So that's the retort that they're going to have to give back.
And Wib, do you see this creating some great social change for us?
I see the potential there, but I want to go back to that concept of ideology that I mentioned. Here I am, a white middle-class male, and I have not personally experienced oppression, social injustice. And what I also find interesting is this, that the protests that have taken place have been primarily in football and basketball. Football, roughly 70% African-American. Basketball, about 75%. And one of these speakers said that you don't see it in baseball. Well, baseball has less than 10% of its players being African-American. You go to a sport like hockey, that's virtually lily white. And so I can't help but think that some of the social experiences that athletes have had is going to impact how much they will play out what has been built up over time.
And we will certainly continue to watch this story unfold. Wib Leonard, sociology professor at Illinois State University, and Cheryl Ray Stout, who is a WBEZ sports contributor. Thank you both for your insights and information. Thank you so much for being with us on the 21st.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Yvonne Greer in for Nyla Boodoo. More than 1 in 10 people in Illinois have a hard time affording the food they need. Having access to a convenient grocery store can be one reason why. For those who are struggling to make ends meet, having to travel longer distances to buy groceries can only make it more difficult. The USDA calls these areas food deserts, counties where more than 20% of the residents live in poverty and where at least 1 in 3 live farther than 1 mile from a large grocery store. Earlier this month, Governor Rauner signed a bill into law that requires the state to do a better job of tracking food deserts. Jim Hyers, president and CEO of the Eastern Illinois Food Bank, joins me now to discuss the issue further. Jim, welcome back to The 21st.
Well, thank you, Yvonne. I'm happy to be here.
Can you give us a sense of perspective as we begin? How did we get to a point where 1 in 10 people in Illinois have a hard time affording food?
Well, that's a long story and a developing story as we talk. Over the last several years, we've been tracking, for much longer than the last several years, people ending up in situations where they have to make decisions about where they spend their money, and high costs of rent in a lot of areas, costs of utilities, medical costs. The last thing that they need is food, and that's where they cut the budgets. So right now, you mentioned 1 in 10. In our particular area, it's 1 in 7 individuals who struggle from food insecurity every day, having to make a choice between buying food and paying for other essentials.
So we end up with these food deserts. Is that because when people have to make these tough choices and choose to take less food in, do the stores move out of those communities? Do families move away from the larger communities to save money on rent? Which comes first, chicken or egg, I guess, is the question.
Well, I think development of a food desert is not a simple equation. There are food deserts in metropolitan areas, and there are food deserts in rural areas, and I think we deal primarily in rural areas. We've seen this evolve over the last several years. At one time, in a lot of rural areas, there were neighborhood grocery stores. Individuals could walk to a grocery store that wasn't a large supermarket, but handled all the food that they would possibly need. Mm-hmm. And I remember as a kid growing up, you could even charge your food in those areas and wait till payday to pay for that at that local store. Eventually, local stores went by the wayside to supermarkets. And then supermarkets went to larger supermarkets and superstores, and smaller supermarkets eventually closed. Along with that, the population in the rural areas is aging, as younger people don't stay, move away to metropolitan areas or larger communities where they can find work or where there is work. So that problem exasperates itself as it grows. The problem now has gotten very, very serious, particularly in our rural areas, and we have to address that every day in what we do in providing food to those areas.
So what are some of the challenges that start to pile up for these families when there's no grocery store nearby?
Transportation. The population in most of these rural counties is aging very rapidly, and transportation becomes a very, very big issue for somebody who might be living alone or an elderly couple who just can't get to a facility or to a grocery store on a regular basis, and along with that, getting to medical needs and as well. So that is a big, big issue. Secondly is the nutrition that those families are able to access has gone down because the variety of foods that are available to them are no longer there. So you may be able to get supplied with some food, but it's not going to be the nutritiously dense food that people need.
Have you seen a change in people's medical or health situations because of this?
I think there is an underlying cause of health issues related to food and food insecurity. People who are food insecure often have more problems than other people when it comes to health issues, particularly things around diabetes, high blood pressure, health problems associated with nutrition, low birth weight, rather. Mm-hmm. All those are connected with not being able to sustain yourself with nutritional food. And if it's not available, then you eat what is available.
Certainly, I can understand the transportation issue when it comes to the rural areas and also especially in the aging population. What's the difference between some of the food desert backlash in a rural community versus in an urban community?
Well, in an urban community, grocery stores have left neighborhoods for one reason or another. Either the population in those neighborhoods changed, wasn't profitable, they've gone to more superstores. Again, the smaller supermarket that might have been owned by a family and was in business for many, many years, finally just could not keep up financially with the larger supermarkets that might be, you know, 20 blocks away instead of 5 blocks away. And so I think if you, particularly if you go to the city of Chicago, there are neighborhoods that really, really rely on, again, the convenience store instead of the grocery store.
And so a convenience store as opposed to the grocery store offers what for people in terms of food? What are they eating?
They're eating processed food, packaged lunch meats, lots and lots of carbs because it's less expensive, snack items, smaller portions, canned soups. The quality of the food, obviously fresh produce is not normally available at a convenience store. And fresh produce, as we well know, is a mainstay for a healthy diet.
This new law seems like just a first step, examining and identifying where these food deserts exist. And it doesn't seem to have a lot of money attached to it. So the state is now collecting information, but based on what you know, are you looking to see specific policy solutions come out of this new legislation to fight hunger in Illinois?
Well, I think it's grand that the issue has now been brought up to the point that there's legislation around looking at it. But in the end, the problem is going to have to be solved, and that's only going to be solved with action provided and money to provide that. We're going to have to incentivize grocers to locate in these areas and make it profitable for a business to set up and provide service to areas. Right now, in lots of cases, maybe the local food pantry is the only place some people are getting the kind of food that they need.
Are there any initiatives underway, or have you seen this work? Have there been some initiatives that were put forth so that a grocer or a large chain grocery store might come into a community with some incentives from its local city government, for example?
I have not seen that yet, and particularly in our area, I have not seen that. Some of the areas up in the metropolitan area, for example, Walgreens started offering produce in some of their local drug stores in areas that were considered food deserts. Very, very small effort, but an effort at that. But I think in our areas, they're going to have to make sure that they make it easy for someone to stay in business as a grocery.
One report about food deserts is that as a little older, from 2006, I believe this report came from, focusing on the Chicago area, saying that there were areas where almost all of the residents were Black. Do you find that food deserts tend to create these little pockets of communities where there's a certain segment of the community that they tend to gravitate towards, such as a Black or Latino population?
I will have to say yes. There is that component. Grocers or businesses are going to build and maintain where they can maintain a continued profit or feel that they can cover their expenses and make a profit. I think in some of those neighborhoods, particularly in Chicago, as pointed out with that study in 2006, that those areas were left because they were not economically viable for a grocery chain to be there.
And what are you hoping to see from the Illinois Department of Public Health on this issue of food access?
Well, we partner with the Illinois Department of Public Health and the Illinois Department of Human Services on a regular basis. I think just recognizing the fact that we now have said, okay, we have a problem in Illinois. We have a problem in our rural areas. We have a problem in our cities. How are we going to address this? Bringing this problem to the table, bringing those people to the table to talk about it, I think is a very, very big first step.
And what are you hoping to see from the USDA in this regard?
We always want help from the USDA. In fact, we get our commodity program from the United States Department of Agriculture. And, of course, the SNAP program is a USDA component. But it doesn't matter. The USDA does not put food necessarily in people's homes. They have to be able to access the food, regardless what programs the USDA has. The commodity program is given to food banks and food pantries across the country. We provide food to people to supplement the food that they get, but it's very, very difficult to provide for all their needs that manner.
I know we're talking about food deserts, but when it comes to the issue of fighting hunger in general, food deserts are probably just one of the many kinds of information you look at to understand the problem. What other types of information are you looking at as far as this feeding people issue is concerned?
We look at the demographics of every area that we work in. How many? What's the age of the people who live there, particularly in our rural areas? I said they're aging. We look at the makeup of schools. For example, we look at the ratio of free and reduced lunch in a school. We have one particular school in one of our counties where 100% of the students are on free and reduced lunch. So we recognize in areas that where we need the work to be done, we look at we can take census tracking and tell you exactly where people are food insecure and take means to address that, such as providing mobile food pantries, working with a local church or 501c3 organization to set up a food pantry or supplemental food program. But our hope is that legislation, for example, requiring schools to offer free breakfast and a free lunch to students, particularly breakfast, I think is a big, big, big help for youngsters. But then we still have to address senior health as well.
Are there any programs in other counties or other nearby states that you're sort of looking at as this is successful there? Can we mimic that program and be successful here?
Well, we belong to a network of food banks called Feeding America, and we collectively get together three or four times a year and talk about what is happening in states adjacent to us around the country and looking at models. And most of the things that we've done, we've adopted or shared with other food banks. Our mobile food pantry program, we deliver primarily to rural areas. And last year, we delivered 60 days we were out. Those 60 mobile food pantries are essential in those areas where we don't have a food pantry or we don't have a grocer available. We took those models from other food banks and said, okay, how can we do that better? The other one obviously is across the state and other states providing for breakfast in the classroom, so making sure that students do get fed and that they at school, and programs after school as well. We run backpack programs for students when they went home over the weekend so that we knew that their families were going to have something to eat. So it's very, very creative, but it only touches the problem because it comes down to the fact that hunger is a symptom of, is an outgrowth of poverty. We have to improve people's lives, and we hope that we can take care of the food issues so they can improve their lives, both on the health side and on job opportunities.
And to those listening to this program who might be able to help some and are wondering, what can I do as just a member of my community? How can they help?
Well, they can volunteer. That's one of the biggest things people do throughout our entire state and in our region. Find your local food pantry, volunteer there, understand what your school is doing around breakfast and lunch, and understand the needs of the senior population in your areas. Also, take a look at how your community is set up in terms of where there is a grocery store. How far are you away from a superstore? What does the transportation look like? And then once we understand that, I think things can be done. If there are opportunities to talk to your elected officials, make sure you ask them about the safety nets provided for elderly and people that are food insecure, and so that they understand that it is a community problem, and it's one I think we can solve together.
Jim Hyers, President and CEO of the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. Thank you so much for being with us on the 21st.
Yvonne, thank you very much.
That's all we have time for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play the 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, and every other way to contact us via phone, email, or social media is on our website, 21stshow.org. Follow us on Twitter. Search for 21st Show. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, search for the 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montecilio, Bob Holly, and Sean Newman. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Yvonne Greer, in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.